Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
There's a difference between being viable and electable. A viable candidate is a candidate who can win their party's nomination.
Right.
And an electable candidate is a candidate who can win a general election. And they're often different. 2008, 2012, Rand Paul was an electable guy. He was not viable because Rand Paul could never win a primary. Harris is an electable candidate that was never viable. Like she there was never a primary that she could have won. But if she's at the top of the ticket, she's probably going to pull this off.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. So glad you could take a moment and spend some time with us. I'm so glad you could also find me on iHeartRadio and the Apple Podcasts and Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. I love it when you do that. I'm really excited about this conversation as we are in convention week and the kickoff of the Kamala Harris, Tim Walz, epic run for the White House. I've got two really good friends who are going to take some time. We brought together the barbershop and the beauty salon to do a little combo meal for everybody this morning and this afternoon and evening, whenever you're watching this. I really, really appreciate having Sophia Nelson in the house for this conversation. She's an award-winning author and journalist, renowned international inspirational speaker, and certainly for me, a good friend. She regularly appears on CNN, MSNBC, and PBS as a legal and political analyst. She is an award-winning diversity and equity and inclusion trainer, speaker, and thought leader, the author of many very, very popular and successful books. And joining her is my friend, Dr. Jason Johnson, professor of politics and journalism. Really excited to have Jason be a part. He focuses on campaigns and politics and all the stuff that goes in creating good political communication and strategy. He is a political analyst for MSNBC, a colleague of mine over there, contributor for The Griot, and host of the Slate podcast, A Word with Jason Johnson. We've got A Word with Jason Johnson and Sophia Nelson coming up next right here on the Michael Steele Podcast.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast, everybody. I'm Michael Steele. It is so much fun. I'm looking forward to this conversation because, man, I tell you, we are here at convention week. I'm in an undisclosed location. Don't tell nobody. Because I'm working out of hotel rooms these days. Unfortunately, I'm not at the convention. I am in New York, but as excited as anybody to watch this convention unfold. And I'm really glad to kick off this conversation about this convention week with two of my friends, Dr. Jason Johnson and Dr. Sophia Nelson. I give her that D. Do you have the doctor? Because I know you were teaching at some really high levels. So
I got it. I have an honorary. So, but I have a JD.
We call you like Dr. Him? Yeah. You got honorary. We call you doctor with the honorary. That's not a problem.
I have a JD like you.
It counts.
It counts.
I always say it counts unless I'm in a hospital. So it's
absolutely.
Well, there is that.
You know, my friend, the late Congressman John Lewis, was here. He'd say this is going to be some good trouble on this podcast here.
Yes, it is.
This is a bad trio of bad news. So
So it's, you know, it's one of those things that we have a lot happening around us. Before we even get into where the Democrats find themselves at this moment, I think wholly by accident, because the way this thing was moving directionally, this would not be the outcome that you would think, as we look at Kamala Harris about to become the first Black woman to run for president, to be nominated by her party to be its champion for the presidency. But you had folks, I mean, just the alignment of very bad stars. All right. You had Donald Trump coming off of a debate in which not only did Joe Biden pancake, he just completely really didn't show up. And so he owned that moment, and you thought, bam, he's rocking. Oh my God, he's got all this love coming off of this debate for, you know, folks who are just so strong into Trump. No bump. Then he goes, you know, gets ready for his convention, and right before his convention, he gets shot. And you think, oh man, sympathy. Oh my God, you know, the former president shot going in. That's, you know, people are going to rally to him in that moment. No bump. Goes to the convention. He announces J.D. Vance as his vice presidential nominee. Surely now this is going to create all kinds of new energy. Young 39-year-old U.S. senator, hillbilly elegy, the man who speaks to the working poor and the middle class. No bump. Comes out of the convention after what was probably one of the worst convention speeches on record. Again, no bump. The difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump on pre-debate was 4 points going into that debate. The difference between Donald Trump and Joe Biden post convention, GOP convention, 6 points. So Biden only lost 2 points. What did that say at that time about what people were thinking about the state of the race at that moment? And so I'm asking you kind of go back and give me some analysis and thinking from that period, because in my estimation, it really does set up where we are right now. But when you look back on that period to see after all of that activity, all of that political drama that occurred, bad debate, presidential candidate being shot, rollout of a vice president, big convention, all of this other stuff, 2 points separated the two presidential nominees at that time. What was your sense of that moment? Jason?
I'll start. So there's a couple of things. One, prior to the dropout and pop out, right? We like to call it. Prior to that happening, it always seemed to me like this is pretty much in the margin of error. But what I was hearing from my friends who are Democrats is that they were terrified that the internal number suggested that the bottom was about to fall out. Because Joe Biden was not holding the coalition from 2020. They're like, he's only carrying like, you know, 83 to 85% of the people who voted for him last time. So even though the numbers were within range, and I was one of the people who was like, hey, you got to stick with the guy because the alternative would be crazy. People who were living in the data were like, ugh, this is not looking good. This is not looking good. In a similar way, Trump's success and Trump's polling was really only a reflection of the weakness of Biden, not necessarily an expansion of the number of people who like the guy. Because I, you know, I'm always quick to point out, like, if you're looking at any polls, and I tell people this, I'll tell my students this, I say this on air, I say this to, we're all that person in people's lives that they call us when they're scared about politics and ask us questions. I was like, any polling where nobody is getting 49% of above, it pretty much doesn't matter. If you see a poll that's like, oh, Trump is leading Biden in Pennsylvania 46 to 42, I was like, you don't have 8% undecideds in an election between two incumbents. So that's it. They're not pushing their leaners enough. They're not pushing enough information. So that's what I saw. And I'll say this just really quickly about the succession of those events. You know, I know it's dangerous to say so, But I'm going to say this as a political analyst because of what I hear. It's not what I think, it's what I hear. You had that terrible debate. And if you look at the numbers, Joe Biden's numbers weren't damaged by the debate performance. They were damaged by the Democrats doing firing squad. Voters didn't change their opinion.
Nancy
and former President Obama stabbing him in the front and the back and the side. That's what did it. It was not regular people. I was in Atlanta next day, and all the local Georgia Black folks were talking about is like, yo, he was at Waffle House last night. He seemed fine, right? So that's key. There has never been an election in my life where it's been so obvious the divergence between the DC, New York, Acela corridor press and how regular people are looking at this. I've never seen the gap so wide. The second thing is, and this is the dangerous thing to say, I am sorry, but if you look online, not Twitter, you can't trust that, but Instagram and YouTube bloggers, there are large numbers of Americans who did not respond to the assassination attempt on Donald Trump the way the DC press did.
Again, thank you.
Come on now. The far right people didn't buy it. The far right people thought it was some conspiracy for Joe Biden to kill Donald Trump. And I know a lot of other people who were just your middle of the road Americans who were like, I don't buy that photo. Now, we're supposed to not say that as political analysts. Look, I believe it. Like, a man died, right? Like, clearly it was an assassination attempt.
Right. But
I would be lying if I said that I'm not just talking about my barber shop. I met lots of people who were like, you don't buy that picture. I was like, whoa, really? I mean, somebody died. They're like, yeah, I don't know, man. It looks set up. It looks fixed, blah, blah, blah. So it was very interesting to me when you were talking about those numbers that it didn't give Donald Trump a sympathy bump. Because I think the hard right people thought it was a conspiracy, and a lot of the mushy middle thought it was a conspiracy, and it didn't seem to do anything.
Well, see,
the only group of people who were completely like, aren't you paying attention to logic, was the DC press. And I think they were really out of touch with how Americans were looking at it.
Jason hits all the right numbers for me on this, Sophia, because that last point that he just made about what people were saying in barbershops and shopping centers, I found it at the Giant in Prince George's County, right? I'm standing in line at the post office and people looked at him and said, one woman said that, I don't believe any of it. And I just, and you know what is interesting in the irony, Sophia, is that this is the land and the space that Donald Trump created.
Right.
Donald Trump created an environment such that the man gets shot and people don't believe it. They did not rally to him because he has so sown the environment, the political environment, and our ecosystem, our ethos, with this, I call it poison, that we look at everything now, we're like, yeah, okay, that's fake. That's fake. That's not real. That's conspiracy. And because he has subtly drawn us into his way of looking at things and thinking about things, that when real shit happens to him, everybody's like, well, okay, was that ketchup? Because you remember how the Secret Service pushed it down? They were putting ketchup. I don't know, but they were putting ketchup on his head. But to Jason's point, a man actually was shot and killed. So they were real bullets. But people are what?
I think you both said a lot to unpack there, and we'll never be able to do it justice in the time we have. But I think I want to look at this a little bit differently. I think everything Jason said is on point. The debate to me was fascinating, not because Vice President Biden, because President Biden did so poorly. It was the way the media reacted afterwards that to me is still something that we're going to be looking at a decade from now.
Right.
And how the media really drove someone out of the political race. Like, President Biden didn't catch a break from June 27th until the moment he dropped it. Now, Jason is right there. We're backstabbing. I mean, Adam Schiff and you can see that Pelosi crew moving, and you can see the leaks. And every time you thought the president would catch his breath and maybe come back, you know, he had a couple good follow-up rallies, they would hit him again. And I think that's the real story here, how the media really drove Joe Biden out with the help of some undercover Democrats like Obama, Pelosi at all. But I don't think we'd ever seen anything like that before. And then juxtapose that with Trump and the assassination attempt and everything else that happened, his speeches, the rambling, the incoherence, calling Pennsylvania, North Carolina, calling the vice president ugly and dumb and low IQ and things that, Michael, 20 years ago, you could not have said and been right. A presidential candidate. And the media does absolutely nothing about it. They don't scrutinize it. They don't talk about it. They don't call on Trump to drop out when he clearly is not. He's in cognitive decline. I mean, I'm not a therapist and I'm not, an analyst of people's mental health. But the bottom line is that Trump clearly has declined at 78 years of age. He cannot complete thoughts. He did not offer a coherent economic plan or anything else. And so I think the big story here, Michael and Jason, for me is that the power of the media in the bubble in Washington really has driven this campaign in a way like something I've never seen before. And it makes me a little nervous because I don't know what they're going to do to Vice President Harris next. You know, they already started.
Well, they want her badly.
Right. They're like, why isn't she talking to us? Why isn't she giving us, a press conference? Why isn't she sitting down with us? So I think she's doing it all right at the moment. I'm very impressed with the campaign, but I have big concerns about these debates and, how they're going to play for her and what the media is going to do to her.
So go ahead, Jason.
So, Sophia, I agree with this. And that's sort of what I was saying about, I have never seen a greater disconnect between what the DC press and the Acela Corridor are saying. I spent a lot of time, not just in California, I spent a lot of time out of DC for various reasons, right? And so I was in North Carolina, I was in Georgia, and it wasn't necessarily for work. It was just being around people. It was a summer vacation, writing and everything else like that. And look, there's always been a difference, but for 8 years, and I know Michael's going to get to this because I can't wait for him to ask this specific question, but it's like for 8 years since 2015 and he announced, the political press of America, and I always make this specific for the audience. When I say political press, I mean 24-hour cable, The Hill, Washington Post, and Politico. It's not Rolling Stone. It's not Daily Beast. It's not Salon. The political press is about five entities. For 8 years now, the political press has been on that narcotic of Donald Trump.
Woo,
okay,
baby.
They have Preach. Made. They are addicted Preach. To Trump for
oh,
eight
baby,
years.
They're different.
And what they wanted is they can't get themselves off of it, right?
Nope.
And they wanted to go back to it because Joe Biden doesn't give them the same level of thrill. And what has been the craziest thing is that they had to go cold turkey for 12 straight days after Joe Biden dropped out. And they were like, oh, I'm clean.
Right.
I'm clean. 12 straight days. I mean, if you think about it, from the moment Joe Biden stepped out, and did a big, middle finger to the Democrats who were trying to get an open convention. Let's not forget that's what they wanted. Joe Biden said, I'm leaving and pulled a Pacino from the end of any given Sunday. I'm going to another team and I'm taking my guys with me. We had 12 straight days of coverage of Kamala Harris and the audiences ate it up. The audience, the cable companies are like, whoa, wait, so we didn't have to just do this? And that Sophia, has been the thing. So now the written political press, the Post and the Times and the Hill and whatever, they're mad because they want in on the action. They want in on the action that the cable networks are getting by Harris, and they're going to attack her until she acquiesces. But as a smart campaign person, if I were her, I'd be like, why bother?
Well,
I got 100,000 white men doing Zooms on my behalf. Yeah. Why do I need to go talk to the Hill?
And that's exactly the point. So that sets us up perfectly for the transition. So you had this amazing transition that everybody wanted, but could not control ultimately. And to your very point, Jason, Joe Biden flipped them the bird and did it his way, because you're exactly right. There were a lot of Democrats around town who wanted that open convention. Because, shall I say it out loud? Oh, dear sir, do. They did not want Kamala Harris as the top of the ticket.
They did not.
They wanted the open convention because they wanted Gavin or Gretchen. And that's what they wanted.
Or Josh.
Or Josh. And they did not want the VP at the top of the ticket. And Joe Biden had the controlled all the cards there and did it his way. Did this very gracious step aside, and then literally less than an hour or so later, pivoted and handed it off to Kamala Harris, which blocked anybody out of contention for this. But what was fascinating was to watch, going back to the conversation about the barbershops and the beauty salons and the grocery stores where Black and brown people, where everyday folks live and operate out of their lives, they consolidated behind her like nothing else. That they consolidated around Biden after the debate, and the political and media classes lost their mind, and then they did everything to get him out, and they did. Then they thought they had this opening in which they could then create another scenario, and it closed very quickly because Joe handed it Kamala, the base consolidated around her, and the energy from that spark has been phenomenal. Within 24 hours, $200 million raised, 170,000 people volunteered for her campaign. You had Zoom calls. The first that was when the sisters decided to have a call and had this phenomenal number of Black women.
There's 50,000 of us on that first
50,000. Talk about that call. I mean, because yeah. I don't think people really appreciate the inside story behind what was happening there.
Well, I think there's an interesting statistic that most people don't know. If you go back to 2020 when she was nominated to be Biden's running mate, only 900 women got on the Black woman's call. That's a very important thing to know. 4 years later, after everything you just said played out, Black women realized very quickly several things. Number one, because I was on some of the planning calls and whatever, and we were talking about this, you know, her sorors, it was a bunch of us. And the thing was, okay, we know they're going to come for her. So we decided we had to come out strong. We didn't expect 50,000. Okay. And then the brothers follow with Roland and those guys with 50,000. And then the white women had 200,000. And it just went from there. And it was like the white women, Shannon Watts gets a lot of credit from me, and Pink, and, you know, all the soccer players and all the white women who said, we got to follow the Black women on this one because Hillary got screwed because we didn't step up. Remember the 53% of white women that voted for Trump in that first election in 16. So I say all that to say that call that we had as Black women was that first line of defense that we're going to have her back because they will come for her. And we weren't clear if they were going to try to broker the convention or what they were going to do. But I think that President Biden played it masterfully, as you said, Michael. And he was like, y'all want me out? Okay, but I'm going to put her in. And right. It's going to be my way or there ain't going to be no way. And I think that she has done something extraordinary because if you remember, Jason, just 2 years ago, they wanted her off the ticket. There were people talking about Biden needs to drop her. And then Clyburn had to step in and say, you ain't dropping nobody, you know, and they did not want her. She didn't run a great campaign in 2019. I mean, you know, we'll all agree with that. But she's done an extraordinary job up to this point, and I'm super excited for her.
So where does that so we now have this new dynamic. You have an alignment or realignment that has occurred right in front of our eyes in the space of 5 weeks. You've gone from Democrats being in a political wilderness that they themselves created, to Jason's point of going after their own nominee for the presidency, to the point where you had just at the end of last week, 70,000 Republicans on a call for Kamala Harris. It is an amazing turnaround. So, all right, folks, what does it all mean? You've got this convention. You've got this energy. Joe Biden is going to get a send-off like no other. There will be tears in that crowd. And a lot of people, particularly in the political class, will be crying and shedding a tear, were the ones who put the knife in his back as they're praising Caesar, if you will. And And yet, despite all of that drama, I put it this way, the American people have decided, and the right tone has been struck by the campaign, to, again, to your point, Jason, that they're not looking back, that they do want to look forward, and they like the feeling that, that joy brings them. You know what? I'm actually having fun again with politics. I'm curious and I'm interested, particularly true with young people. What's your assessment of what all of everything we just talked about, what does that mean for the campaign when the bell rings at the end of the convention and we get through Labor Day and voting starts literally in 20 days from now?
So a couple things. The first thing, you know, we're not going back, but I have to go back in this particular way to get us to now. Can you all, and trust me, we were all caught. I will not forget, because if you remember, Michael, I was on the Sunday show, the weekend show with y'all, and they had the Biden campaign representative said he's not going anywhere.
I know.
And an hour after we left set, he drops out. Like this was that shocking. Like we were just on the air talking about it, sitting there in the studio in DC. And what I have to point to is this: given how relatively impressive this campaign has been for basically only 3 weeks, 4 weeks that they've been able to put together. Can y'all just go back for a second? Can you imagine the freaking chaos that would have been going on if they had held out for an open convention?
Oh, my God.
You know what the last 3 weeks would have looked like?
Yeah.
There is no way that they would have been able to put the genie back in the bottle. We would have had every minute. Look, for the 2 weeks before Harris picked her VP pick, I almost thought Pete Buttigieg had his own show on cable because the man was on TV every night trying to get the job. He was on every show. Walls was all over Instagram and X. Cooper, Newsom, you know, the only person who wasn't out there, you know, basically trying to make themselves available, it was Josh Shapiro. Because I think his attitude was, I'm sitting on 19 electoral votes. You got to
go. Oh, Michael, can we talk about, for a moment, Jason, this? Let's talk about Trump for a second, because the other fascinating story to me, beyond the fact that this played out the way we all just discussed, is Donald Trump has no idea how the hell to run against Kamala Harris.
Right. He's, and that's
JD Vance just keeps insulting women, postmenopausal women, cat ladies, childless chicks, you name it. They just keep pissing women off. And Donald Trump, you know, saying you're better looking than her, and you got people like Dave Irvin and some of these guys been around a long time going, dude, you got to stop talking about this and get on message, but he can't do it. And I think the Republicans are really flat-footed because they needed Biden to stay in. And when Biden left, I think they thought Harris would implode, or that it wouldn't work, or that the Democrats would devour her. It didn't. And the Republicans are flat-footed. Michael, I would love to ask you, as a former chairman, how do you see... Do they get him disciplined? Is that even possible?
No.
Yeah.
No, they won't. And you have now folks in MAGA world calling for Suzy Wiles and Chris LaCivita to be fired. And that is something that is possible because why? Corey Lewandowski was brought back to the campaign. Corey has been brought back to
the
oversee and manage Trump's interests here. Trump believes a couple of things. One, from what I hear from people inside that particular bubble, one, that he wins the election by turning out his MAGA base. He genuinely believes there are more people who are aligned with MAGA than not. And therefore, that vote will turn out for him. Two, that he does not like the way this is played out because his campaign did not plan for Joe Biden stepping aside. He still wants to run against Joe Biden. And so therefore you have these things that come at odds with each other. A campaign that did not plan for because the mastermind is telling them Joe Biden's the guy, we're going to run against Joe Biden. So the campaign never plans for it. So when he's not there, even though every sign indicated to both your points that this was going to happen in some form or fashion. It was either going to be a complete blow up with an open convention, or Joe Biden would do what Joe Biden did. So there was no prep there. And so now with Corey coming back in, the flatlining of the VP choice, where he listened to his sons, from what I understand, he wanted, what's his name, the governor?
Burgum.
He wanted Burgum.
Why did he want Burgum?
Burgum was completely transactional. One, he was old and therefore no competition for Trump. And two, he would drop $100 million into his campaign, right? So that was his interest there. But his sons wanted the young guy. And no one vetted the young guy. And to the extent that they Jason, they ignored the cat lady shit. They ignored the fact that this man has no regard for women.
I have to say this. As an Ohio person, right? I lived in Ohio for a decade. I still have students there. My former student is now the deputy whip of the Democratic Party in the state house, right? Like my connections to Ohio run deep. And I have said this to every single national outlet I can. I was like, J.D. Vance is the Ted Cruz of Ohio. People don't like him personally. He can get reelected because he's got access to the money. He can play MAGA right. But I was like, there is not a bar. And again, Ohioans know these towns I'm talking about. There's not a bar in Niles, Lorain, Toledo, or Akron that J.D. Vance could walk into right now and get a beer. He can't. He can't. People don't like him there. They see him as a phony and a poser. And so, like, that selection to me, it's not just bad that you clearly didn't do any vetting. But the other part about it, which has been so obvious, is like, this is what happens when you have someone who completely changed their personality in order to make themselves more attractive to the MAGA world, right? And then you forget that when the worm turns, you've got all these terrible clips from these right-wing ecosphere places because you thought that stuff was going to work. I don't think J.D. Vance believes half the things that he says.
No, he doesn't. I've heard it from people who know him. He doesn't.
You know, he doesn't. I'm sorry, but real talk. If you have that level of anger and hostility, you don't have former friends in the LGBTQ community. If you're that that racist, you don't name one of your children Vivek. Your kids would be named, you know, Andy and Samantha, right? Like, he clearly turned from a sort of Rand Paul libertarian-esque Republican into some MAGA Cabbage Patch kid, you know, in the hopes of getting to the position he's in now. But all he does is he highlights the terrible beliefs that Donald Trump has without the charm and charisma. So people look at J.D. Vance and like, oh my God, that's right. Trump believes that too. And you're not funny or charming. So now it's reflecting negatively on the head of the ticket.
Don't forget, he said that Trump was America's Hitler. I mean, how do you put that guy on your ticket to be your running mate? Like, that's basic. Damn, I don't know, but you know, Michael, I think to Jason's point, though, the Vance pick is just horrible and it alienates women. And I think women are going to drive this election. And I think, and you can save this, I think this election's over. I think women are going to drive this election. They're not going to let 2016 happen again. And the Republicans double down and they get nastier and meaner and more divisive and more personal. And the more Trump tries to drag her, the more pissed off women are going to get. Conservative women, moderate women, liberal women. I've never seen anything like it before. They are unifying.
I never think any election is over until the day after the election day.
Right.
But what I will say is this, because I've had people point this out. You know, they're like, well, hey, you know, Hillary was ahead by 6 and Biden was ahead by 7 at this particular point. I'm like, in both of those instances, in 2016 and 2020, you had a certain number of people who were technically undecided. I don't think anyone is undecided this campaign. They couldn't have been. You're dealing with, and Harris has this sort of unique magic of like, she can take credit for the things that Biden liked, but all the things that people don't like about Biden, they assume she's going to do it differently, which is an amazing trick. I don't know how people have fallen for that, but they do. It's like, we're going to give you credit for the good stuff and none of the bad stuff. But like, I don't see a break in these numbers. And I want to say this real quick. I talked to, when I came to Michael's class years ago, I talked about this, something I wrote like in my dissertation, whatever it is. And I talked about the difference between candidates. There's a difference between being viable and electable. A viable candidate is a candidate who can win their party's nomination.
Right.
And an electable candidate is a candidate who can win a general election. And they're often different, right? Like in 2008, 2012, Rand Paul was an electable guy. He was not viable because Rand Paul could never win a Republican convention. He couldn't win a primary. Same with Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee, had he gotten to a national ticket, I was like, that guy could win. He was charming. He was funny, blah, blah, blah. But he's not viable. And then there's people like John Kerry. Of course, he was viable because he had the military thing and it was 04, but he was never going to be electable. There's not anybody in America who's like, man, if we'd only gotten a John Kerry presidency. People were willing to deal with four more years of Bush because they got Obama afterwards. Harris might be like my dissertation come true. She is an electable candidate that was never viable. Like she was never, there was not, there was never a primary that she could have won. But if she's at the top of the ticket, she's probably going to pull this off.
Yeah. You know, Jason, you made an interesting point because I did a post on this, like, you know, mentors and sponsors, the difference. Joe Biden is the classic sponsor that said, I'm going to take my power and I'm going to transfer it to her. And I'm going to give her the handoff because she's not going to get a shot if it's an open convention or a primary. She loses.
Yeah.
And her electability, she's got that Obama-esque quality as a female. And she's novel. Her name's novel. All these things. People are intrigued by her story, her background. But I think one of the people I would listen to is Frank Luntz, who's been fascinating to watch, Michael, over these last weeks. Look depressed as he's looking at the poll numbers crater. And the undecideds, Jason, have all broken for Harris. What was left have slid over to Harris.
So, well, he was the, Frank was the one that said, I can't find any women.
He said it. They were focus groups.
Yeah, I can't find any independent women to do focus groups with because they've all aligned with Harris.
And not only have they all sort of aligned with her, but I think the other part, and this is what Sophia said and everything else like that, it's not just that it's sort of being driven by women in this election, but I also think we have the situation where it's very, when people start self-organizing is when you know that you're in trouble, right? These calls, so, you know, Joteka, you know, the Black Women Lead call, that happened every week anyway. This just happened to be a blow-up week. But when Black men got together and Jewish women got together and queer people got together and white women got together, these weren't necessarily coordinated by the Harris campaign. This was people just saying, you know, I'm tired of this Trumpish stuff and I want to do something different. And I think that's what's happening. And I'd love to hear you all thoughts, especially sort of being out there in the campaign and organizing. I always tell people also, you know, you can't, you know, these polls ain't loyal. You can't trust the polls. You have to look at what the campaigns do. Right. And I said, the fact that you've got Harris spending so much time in North Carolina, this is a state that has only gone Democratic twice in our lifetimes. Right. That is all of our lifetimes.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like 76 in 2008. Right. Yeah. It's. There are ways that it looks like the map is starting to expand. And I'll tell you this, Michael, you talk about bumps. I told everybody, you look at this convention. If after this convention, if within a week after this convention, if Harris or Walz goes to Florida or Ohio or Texas, Trump is done.
Yep.
Because that means their internals are saying, we're not going to win Ohio. But we're not going to let you run up this. You're not going to win Ohio by 7. You might only win it by 3. You know what? You're not going to win. We're not going to win Florida. But if we only lose Florida by 3 or 4 and help these Senate candidates against Rick Scott, if they start going to those places, it's over.
That is an absolutely important point to make. And I'll ask everyone who's listening to put a pin in that and remember what Jason just said. And I want to put the particular pin in Florida, because what's happening in Florida could be the upset of this cycle, in addition to winning North Carolina, and you didn't say it yet, but the state of Georgia, in that on the ballot is an abortion initiative in the state of Florida. So Floridians now have an opportunity to give their thoughts after everything Ron DeSantis and Republicans have done to drive women against them. Now women have a chance to respond, and as do men, with that ballot initiative and what impact that may have not just on turnout, but how the vote falls is going to be very telling. Because if they get an overperformance of Democrats supporting, not necessarily Democrats, could it be Republicans, to Sophia's earlier point about Republicans and Republican women in particular on the abortion issue moving towards Kamala? If Democrats are able to overperform in their turnout of people who align with them on abortion or around Kamala, Florida could fall. And or to your point, Jason, if it doesn't fall completely, it could be one of those where the Democrats still lose it, but they lose it by two.
Right.
But Mike, I think North Carolina, that Mark Robinson candidate is a nightmare.
He's just
terrible. And I think North Carolina is going to D column. I just wrote Cooper
I think so too.
Wants to run for the Senate in 2026. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. I think North Carolina is really in play. And I think that Mark Robinson is the reason she wins North Carolina.
North Carolina, I would say even more than Georgia, because Georgia with the voter suppression stuff.
I agree.
Like he is. So I was in Charlotte. It was in June. He is so excruciatingly unpopular, and this is what I was saying about J.D. Vance, where it's like you spend 3 to 5 years doing all these sort of MAGA podcasts and everything else like that because you think it's cute. Do you not realize that when you have to run against a larger audience that's saying women need to keep their skirts down and some people need killing, I don't think it's like they don't realize. Right. They don't realize how bad this is. And I want to add something here. I forgive me if it's too much of a football metaphor, but Sophia, when you were talking about like Joe Biden handing his power and doing the handoff, I've been saying for a while that if Harris pulls this off, like Joe Biden is like the Alex Smith of politics. And if anyone knows, Alex Smith was the guy who lost his job to Kaepernick.
Yeah.
Then he moves to Kansas City and then he loses his job to Mahomes.
Yep.
Biden, if he helps be the guy who helped Barack Obama get elected and the guy who puts Harris in this position, that is a unique spot to be in.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, no one's going to remember Alex Smith in 25 years, but it's like, bruh, you had a hand in two of the most prominent Black quarterbacks in this league in history. Kaepernick for historic reasons and Mahomes for also historic reasons. And that will be a unique place that he plays in history as this juncture point. Because again, if Harris wins, we kind of knew it since Obama, but if Harris actually wins his presidency, there will never be another ticket in history. Assuming we maintain our democracy, there will never be another ticket in history that doesn't have a woman or a person of color. It's never going to happen, even with the Republicans. I don't think if she wins, I don't think that ever happens again.
But the fact that he didn't choose Kim Reynolds of Iowa, with all due respect, I don't get who was doing the math there, Michael. It was Nikki Haley or Kim Reynolds or somebody. How Trump thought he could run without a woman astounds me.
It's how Trump look at women. He doesn't look at them as equally in power as he is. He's not willing to share that power. As we get ready to go to break, I will put one more thing that Joe Biden has done that I think as a political operator and candidate and elected official appreciate, he will have shown us that you can run for the presidency in less than 2 years. We do not have to have a two-year run-up campaign for the presidency. We can do this ish in about 8 to 10 months, primary and general election. Joe Biden is, I said Joe Biden would be a transformative president the day he announced for the presidency. I remember being on Morning Joe and saying, he's going to be the nominee. And everyone looked at me like I was high. And we had not changed the marijuana laws at that time. So no, I wasn't smoking. But I know a little bit about politics and I know a lot about voters, and that would be the guy. He has been everything I thought he would be. And then some.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back right after this.
Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop, because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, and more. Your favorite stores like Lenovo and Wine.com pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers. And Rakuten shares the commission with its members. And that could be you. Cashback is deposited directly into your PayPal account. Or, if you prefer, Rakuten can send you a check. The choice is yours. You can even maximize your savings by stacking cashback on top of other deals, like store sales and coupons. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. June is Men's Mental Health Month, and every year, 6 million men suffer from depression. If you're feeling overwhelmed, the strongest thing you can do is ask for help. And BetterHelp makes it easy. Take a short online quiz and connect from home with a qualified therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. I want to talk to my friends about two very interesting, compelling storylines that evolved at the same time. One around Project 2025 and its videotapes. And the other, a conversation that took place on CNN between Nancy Mace and Michael Eric Dyson. Y'all know where I'm going? If you're not having fun at this point, talking with Jason Johnson and Sophia Nelson, strap in, because it's about to get a little bit buck wild up in here. I mentioned that you had this conversation. Let's start with the trickier one, because it's a little bit more nuanced, and that's Project 2025. And we all know what Project 2025 is, and we damn sure know what it isn't, right? It isn't this benign kind of, oh, we just thought we'd write down some thoughts about, you know, ideally what, you know, a Republican candidate in the future could possibly run. No, this is Donald Trump's playbook. And everyone associated with this project largely came out of Trump world, out of his administration or Trump world directly. Kevin Roberts, who was the president of Heritage, came on my show on MSNBC The Weekend and sat down, and we had a direct conversation about what Project 2025 was about. And he started bragging about it. He even made the point, oh, you know, it's not just getting rid of 50,000 employees. There are 2 million federal employees. We should be eliminating 1 million jobs. Right. So we know what this is. And so this past week, you had released training videos about how they are prepared. Jason is chomping at the bit. How they're preparing to implement everything that's in Project 2025. Tell me your thoughts about that, Dr. Johnson.
It's like the reverse version of Project Veritas. Like, you don't usually see Republicans get caught with their pants down in this way.
Right.
So obvious. you know, it's so bad. And they're so obvious in how they've been busted. And I've said this for a long time. Project 2025, for a party that has, even under Trump, been significantly better at branding than Democrats. I don't know who they test marketed that name with, because It sounds terrible and ominous. Had it been called Project for a Happy America, Future Foundation, whatever you want to call it, it'd be fine. But Project 2025 sounds like a doomsday device from an Austin Powers movie. It really does. And so the way that it spread online, it was the thing, I said it for weeks, it is the thing that people who don't care about politics started to learn about on TikTok.
Right.
It was the thing that 17 and 18-year-olds were telling their 40-year-old parents, have you heard about Project 2025? It was terrible.
And don't forget Jason Taraji saying it at the BET.
Yes. Yes.
And dropping a bomb, and folks were like, what the hell is Project 2025? She did it.
And now they ain't beating the allegations, right? You ain't beating the Project 2025 allegations. So I really think what it's been so foolish for the Republicans. And on top of that, and I just think this is a key part of why it's so bad, it gives, unlike Harris, right, who again is probably going to be able to skirt all the way until the convention. I mean, she's given policy speeches. We have an idea what her policy is, but it gives, again, it's like the reverse contract with America. It puts what the Republicans are on paper in a way that people can openly criticize, and they don't have any way to back out of it because the head of their ticket has no message discipline and the bottom of their ticket has discipline just in the wrong way. So that's what it's been. I've never seen a more incompetently run national campaign than what I've seen from the Republicans, even frankly before Biden dropped out, but especially since.
Well, I think it wasn't so much that it was incompetently run. I'm not going to say it was incompetently run. It was actually run the way they planned it to be run. What they did not expect was the backlash. They thought that this would be, I mean, who's going to sit there and read a 900-page document?
Kids on TikTok.
Right. And so they thought it would be benign. I remember we launched our show the weekend in January. The first time we raised the conversation about, because I knew about Project 2025, because it led to why K. Cole James left Heritage as the Black woman, female president, first Black female president of Heritage. It's one of the reasons she left, because of what they were brewing down in the bowels of Heritage. And they went out and they deliberately got Kevin.
Michael, can we pause there for a second? Because you know I'm close to Kay. You know Kay, of course, and Kay's been a mentor of mine for over 35 years. You're absolutely right. We had this conversation not too long ago, and she said, can you imagine how bad it had to have been for me to leave a role like that?
Yeah.
I really wanted to shape and change things and be more inclusive and
how I felt about the RNC.
Absolutely. But she said
it was tough. And they didn't want to change. Yeah.
She said it was really rough. And she was like, yeah, I'm good. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but you have this sort of this thing that's brewed in the basement. They get the buy-in of the J.D. Vance, who writes the foreword to Kevin's book about it, and all of this stuff. They plan to roll this thing out in a way to make it seem like everything else that rolls out of a policy center, right? No big deal. But when you started to focus on what they actually wrote and leveled up what that meant for what America would look like, the agencies that would be removed and the impact it would have on people's lives. Then you had the whole backlash from Dobbs that kind of rolled into this, you know, changing the Department of Health and Human Services to Department of Life. And people are like, well, what the hell does that mean? Whose life? What the hell are you talking about? That they never thought any of that would happen. And so now they found themselves having to deny, the very work that they spent years crafting and pretending like we don't know what. No, this was just, we were just messing around. We just happened to fall into 900 pages. Joe just couldn't stop writing. I don't know what Kevin just had an idea and put it on paper. They do anything they can say to simplify this. But to your point, Jason, this shit is out.
Yeah.
Y'all got to deal with it now. And I'm going to slather you up with it every day. Every day you're going to own every inch of those 900.
I think you're going to hear it every night, Michael, at the DNC. Every night they're going to talk about Project 2025, particularly in prime time.
Absolutely. They need to.
And the foolishness of it is that nobody seems to have an idea about how to frame it, right? Like, you know, be proud of your stuff, right? Like, again, you wrote 900 pages. Why don't you have anybody out there defending it? If you keep pulling the Shaggy defense, it wasn't me. Then that just makes people, more suspicious. Why is there not somebody out there saying, well, yes, Project 2025, you know, we've got this section on tax cuts and we've got this section on reorganizing government. The fact that you have nobody out there willing to defend the project is part of what makes people so uncomfortable with it,
right?
Because they're like, well, you don't want to stand by this thing that we know that you wrote.
So the other interesting storyline that fell out of the stars or crept up out of the sewer, depending on how you look at it, was a conversation that took place on CNN between Congresswoman Nancy Mace of South Carolina, Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, and Keith Boykin. And the conversation revolved around the fact that during the course of the interviews that they were part of, the Congressman Mace, who I now refer to as Macy, continued to abuse the use of mispronounce Kamala Harris's name, deliberately mispronouncing her name. And Dr. Michael Eric Dyson kept saying, why do you do that? Why do you know how to say her name? Why do you keep saying her name wrong? And Keith and he and she got into this roundabout on this topic. And she declared, I can say her name however I want to. So Congresswoman Macy, just so you know, I'm saying your name how I want to say it. So just, and there are a few other names I have for you too that I may share. But what was more interesting was what came afterwards, where she tweeted out with the video clip, these boys got agitated about what I said. And the fact that this white woman from South Carolina,
Congresswoman,
would refer to two adult black men, professionals, as boys.
Who are probably Jason, older than her.
Like, who are older seniors. Than her.
Yeah.
Yes. Who are older than her.
Yes.
And she deliberately used, she from South Carolina, she knows what the hell you the use of a the word the boys mean.
She knows.
When you say that kind of ish, you know what that means. So don't sit there and act all innocent and pretend that you don't. And it is reprehensible that, you know, her complaint is I was interrupted over 10 times last night by the radical left who don't respect women. I'm like, are you serious? That's your go-to excuse, that you were interrupted. And so that gives you the room to refer to them as boys?
Michael, let me say this. Nancy Mace is a general's daughter. She went to the Citadel. She's a daughter of privilege. She's a daughter of the South. She feels entitled, as she said, to say what she wants to say, how she wants to say it. She knows that boys is a reference, as you mentioned, very denigrating, very debasing to black men in the South. And she doubled down on it on social media. They are being very intentional in my former party. You're still a Republican. And they're very clear about the rhetoric they want to use to, again, excite MAGA. They're wrong.
They are wrong. And just so we know exactly, so for the record, what she exactly said, in response to Michael Eric Dyson saying, you are a white woman that is disrespecting a black woman by saying that you can call her whatever you want to call her. And her response was, these boys were easily triggered.
I'm going to say this. So, you know, I'm sure everybody here, y'all remember the famous Key and Peele sketch about the black teacher. And he's like, Balake.
Yes. Yeah.
Jake Quellen. The whole point of the sketch, for those who aren't familiar with it, is the black substitute teacher comes into the white class and just starts mispronouncing all the kids' names.
That's right.
You know, Balake. What kind of name is Balake? It's Blake. You know, like that. So the idea being that this idea of sort of cultural competence and respect for names is key, right? You call me what my name is, you figure out how to pronounce it. It is a general level of respect, right? The story out there where, you know, supposedly the senator said to at the time, Senator Harris, I can't pronounce your name. And she's like, well, I'll just call you whatever. Like all these kinds of things, right?
Right.
So that's the baseline. But I want to take it to a different place, and I want to be very, very careful about this because I always want to be respectful to colleagues. When I saw that clip, it reminded me of a kind of news coverage that I had felt we had finally moved away from since like 2016, 2017, which was, let's get actively offensive MAGA people on the air, put them on with people of color or women, and let that person just behave inappropriately until somebody gets angry, and then you get a viral clip.
Yeah.
And part of this is a failure to simply manage the conversation.
And that is a fair point, because that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
That was a free-for-all.
Yeah, like, and again, I wanna be respectful. I don't know what the editorial or what the producer responsibilities were. I don't know what was happening on the ground. So I don't want to say anything critical about somebody. I don't know what was happening in that moment, what was in whatever person's ear. But if I have a guest and I am managing a panel and somebody's name is being mispronounced, it is not the job of the panelists to police that. It is the job of the producers. It is the job. I thought we'd move past that sort of crossfire stuff. And that's what I found. So just Nancy Mace is going to be Nancy Mace. Michael Eric Dyson knows how to handle things. Keith Boykin knows how to handle things. But it's like, this shouldn't be happening. These sort of fake crossfire-esque arguments, this sort of, you know, sheepdog and wolf sort of things that we used to do on the news, we got to stop that. It doesn't make for good TV.
Can we go back, Jason, to what we all talked about earlier with President Biden and the nonstop, whether it was MSN or CNN or whoever it was, they kept bringing these MAGA types on. Mm. And all of us were pissed off. You could see it on the Twitter feeds. Michael, you were upset. I was upset. Jason was upset because we couldn't believe that exactly what you're talking about, Jason, was happening every day, all day, where it was just unbelievable stuff being thrown about on television about Joe Biden being senile, he had Alzheimer's, he had whatever, and there was no management by the anchors to shut it down, to fact check. They just let it run wild.
I think part of that, again, I always want to give people grace, not mace. I want to give people grace and how they may be managing things in the moment, right? Like, I'm not in the room for every single production show. You know, Michael, we've all done shows. So I want to be fair to people. But I will say that, like, the bias, this goes back to what I was saying in the beginning, the bias of the political press, because they've been on the Trump narcotic for so many years, does tend to manifest itself in this sort of inequality of coverage. I said during that debate, I think I said this on Michael's on the podcast last time, I was like, the post-debate coverage was so negative and so slanted in favor of Trump. I was like, Trump could have pooped all over himself during the debate.
Yeah.
And the headline in the New York Times the next day would have been, Biden fails to respond to explosive charges, right? Yeah. Like, that's what they would have done.
Yeah.
It was that bad. And so, yes, when MAGA people come on the air and they're not in a real conversation, like having somebody from Project 2025 come on the weekend and argue in favor of his crazy policy, that's actually how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to have people who are in a policy position making their argument. You're not supposed to have bomb throwers on the air, you know, who offer no news and no new information just so that you can get a viral moment. That's what tends to bother me, because I don't think those people provide anything other than toxicity. And this is a key thing. What the networks have discovered, shocker, shocker, is that after 8 years of this, after 8 years of the Nancy Maces and the Viveks and the all the people doing that kind of stuff, you know what they like watching? They like watching Coach Walls because he makes you feel good.
Yeah.
They like watching Harris because she makes you feel good. She makes you laugh from time to time. People don't want to watch that negative. There's enough bad things in the world. We don't need to watch that.
To that point, Jason, it's not that people don't want to watch, because they don't want to watch. That's a given. But what they realize, I think now, is they don't have to anymore.
Well, yeah.
They don't have to. I don't have to watch the crap you're putting in front of me. I don't have to wait to be told that something is good or bad. I now see that there are other lanes that are existing or being created that I can get into and travel a different route. 8 years of everything. I mean, stop and think about it. And I'll put it in this terms because it's the only way it comes about. For 8 years, the press every day has us talking about, thinking about, and responding about and to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
That's the one name of all other names that has been spoken and written every effing day since 2016. There has not been a moment, not an event, not a time when at some point somebody references that ass. And Kamala Harris has come along and said, yeah, I don't got to do that anymore.
Yeah.
That, you know what? This reminds me when she said it, I instantly thought of the gospel verse that usually is spoken about at funerals, where you say, you talk about, we're now in a sorrowful moment, but joy comes in the morning. Mm-hmm. This is the connection, folks, between mourning in America, Reagan, and this sense of joy in this era, right? And I just, you know, the same impact that mourning in America had on the country in 1984, right? When the country coming through tough times and recession and all that, that there was this better day ahead. This is what this joyful moment is that she's talking about. And people are like, oh, my God, you mean I don't have to talk about Donald Trump?
I don't have to,
the most fun I had in the last 8, 9, 10, 12 months. You know what the most fun I had was yesterday on the weekend show where we actually got to talk about Kamala Harris's economic policy. We were talking. I stopped at one point and Sean went, oh my God, I don't know what to do. This is so exciting that I'm actually sitting here talking about what, you know, the impact of not taxing income wages for waiters and so forth, tip wages. It's such a different space that we've not been in.
And I think, Michael, you hit on something. You know, my last book was about mental well-being and being what you need, and this period of coming through COVID for the country. And that's what she's offering. There's been a period of mourning, of sickness, of death. We couldn't bury our grandmothers and grandfathers, right, and parents. And people forgot what it was like under Trump. It wasn't good. It wasn't joyful. It was crazy. And she's saying it's time to come into something else now. We're not going back, which I think is a great slogan.
Yeah.
And so I think that you're right. It's joy, but it's also, it's time to turn the corner.
Yeah.
Young people, mental health is very important to them. Stuff matters now. And she connects those dots for people.
Yeah, she does. She does. Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, and I also think that there's an element of like, I learned a lot. I talked to Bradley Whitford, right? So just a little context, after so many people jumping on me about it for years, I was advised by one of my friends to finally watch The West Wing, right? I had never watched The West Wing.
Really?
So I'm binge watching The West Wing now. I know. This is a huge confession. I have these gaps in TV because I was in school. I was a broke grad student. I don't.
Yeah, but you know, he was also an intellectual. His brother was in the books. That's what
I hadn't had time. So I finally, you know, I'm in like season three, right? I'm in season three. Spoiler, everyone, Mark Harmon dies, right? So I'm in season three of West Wing. And what I've been thinking about a lot is also how our presidents are the narrative story about what we want to say about ourselves.
Yep.
Right?
I've always said that.
Yeah. So you look at what we had. And it was what Nikki Haley said back in January. We got two 78-year-olds, you know, whichever party dumps theirs first. The narrative that people can tell themselves now is, after years of feeling like we want gun control, we want this, and the party's not listening, You literally had a party dump their candidate 4 months out because they were listening. Yep. Like from a branding perspective, people are like, oh, they listened.
Right.
Whoa, the parties can do things. And then now you have this idea of like, I want to be associated with the party that said, we hear you. And even though it's weird and unprecedented, we're going to do this thing. We're going to do this thing that we think is better for everybody. And the Trump campaign and the Republicans in general, they're not giving us a story that people want to say about ourselves. And here's why I mentioned Bradley Whitford. So I talked to some folks who did the white dudes for Harris call.
Right.
He was on it. And it was him and another guy. And what they said, which I thought was fascinating for white men, is they're like, yo, after 8 years, we're tired of being told to be afraid all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like white dudes are always under assault. They're telling us to be afraid of this. They're telling us that we don't have this. They're telling us we don't have that. Like we're tired as white men of being told everything sucks. And I was like, when you've got white guys changing like that, saying, yeah, I'm, you know what, man? I just want to take my daughter to school.
Yes.
I want to co-parent with my ex-wife and take my girlfriend on a trip. I'm tired of you talking about carnage in the streets. Like when you're getting that guy to say, I'm done, I'll go with Coach Walls and Harris. That's where you see the worm turning.
Yeah.
Because people want to tell themselves a different story. And Trump doesn't give you a story of hope. He gave you a story of change in 2016 and it didn't happen. And now people want, as you said, Sophia, they want a story of, yo, this could get better. Or at least it ain't miserable every day. Right. And I just think you can't buy that kind of brand change. You can't sell that in message. You had to show it by removing Joe Biden and having a campaign that has run pretty darn well by all accounts. And picking somebody who we cannot say this enough, but like, how the hell did you stumble upon Tim Walz? I'm sorry, but a 60-year-old man who doesn't own any stocks after 12 years in Congress is amazing.
Okay. Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
a 60-year-old man who doesn't own any real estate. Now, I think that's crazy having been in Congress, but I know a lot of people that applies to.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, well, you get it. That's the only thing you
own.
He breaks that that narrative that members of Congress go to Congress to get wealthy, rich, and become out of touch. And he's still the coach. He's still the guy who can tell you how to refix your F-150. He's the guy who's going to sit there with his grandkids on his lap and just have fun with them because that's what granddads do. He's that guy. And so now you've reframed the entire conversation in a way that, with all respect to my man, Joe Biden couldn't do any longer.
No.
And so Joe Biden was the quintessential granddad, right? He was the guy in the neighborhood who would walk up and down the block, good morning, Mrs. Smith. Oh, I love your flowers this morning. So have, you know, the kids would come run up, give him a hug, and keep going. You know, he was that guy. But there even comes a point where that's not enough.
Yeah.
And you need something else to sort of take you to the next part of the conversation. Sophia, you were going to say?
I think that Harris, though, you're going to get a masterclass, men are in this country, of how women lead differently. Women know this, how women manage homes and jobs, careers and marriages and kids and grandkids. It's EIQ. And Harris is connecting in a way that Trump has no ability to connect. And you're going to see, you've seen it with other world leaders that are women. We lead differently. We do build consensus. We are more likely to listen and to take a bunch of things in and go, well, I don't know. I might want to do this. I might want to do that. Whereas men are kind of very different on how you lead. So I think that she's just in the right moment at the right time, guys. And I think, like I said, I think this election's over. I just do. It's the AKA in me, I guess. But I really think the election is over. And I think she's going to win resoundingly. I don't think it's going to be as close as people think it's going to be.
So I want to say this quick. What I will say to that, because I think there's another fascinating gender element to this, Sophia, that I'd love to hear your thoughts on. One, what I think might, you know, it's sort of, you know, deep and wide or narrow. I can imagine it being a very close election, but not close in the Electoral College. Like she ends up winning Pennsylvania and North Carolina and Arizona by 20,000 votes, but she ends up taking some states that you haven't seen somebody take before. That's what I suspect is going to end up occurring. But this is something else that I think is telling from a gender perspective in this election. So I had the opportunity on my podcast, A Word with Jason Johnson on Slate, my own little self-plug. I interviewed second gentleman, very possibly soon to be first gentleman, Doug Emhoff. So I interviewed Doug Emhoff like 3 weeks ago. Fascinating conversation. We were at the DNC. And one of the things I took from it, which I think comes into play, is, and I asked him this directly. I was like, what is it like to be a very successful man, but have an icon as a spouse? And that is a different thing that I think American men are comprehending. Yeah. We're in a space now where it's like, you can be Travis Kelce, a top three tight end of all time Super Bowl winner, but you're still with Taylor Swift, right?
Right.
You can be Jay-Z, you're one of the greatest rappers of all time, but you're not Beyonce, who is a global icon, right?
Right.
And we're getting to this place where men are more comfortable with this idea of like, not because I'm weak, not because I'm a simp, not because I can't believe she gave me the chance, but men are like, my wife is freaking awesome. And I'm proud of that. And well, I stand by her.
It's a generational shift. I mean,
yeah.
But I don't know. I'm not going to say it's generational. I'm going to tell you why. Because you got Josh Hawley out there that would have a different take on this exact conversation. He would look at Jay-Z and Kelce and Emhoff as weak men,
right?
Because they let their women run them.
Mm-hmm.
And as opposed to them running their women. That's his whole thing about, you know, masculinity. I mean, what's your definition of masculinity? It's not your compassion. It's not your willingness to die to self, to promote someone else over you, particularly your spouse or your girlfriend or the woman in your life. That's not what that masculinity is about. They're pissed that men like Jay-Z, like Emhoff, are saying it's okay to have a woman head of household. It's okay. My mama was head of my household.
Yeah.
My dad didn't tell you in a heartbeat who ran the house. Right?
Yeah, Michael, here's what I was saying. Generationally, when I wrote my first book, Black Woman Redefined, we did a lot of research and we had a lot of focus groups with Black men. Ironically, the pollster in that book was a woman named Kellyanne Conway, and she had the polling company. She hired all Black women and men to do this. The book, as you know, did very well, won awards, but one of the things we heard from Black men was it was a generational where they felt that they had to be that breadwinner. They weren't comfortable with the Black female lawyer or doctor, particularly in our community. And what I think I see shifting, because as you know, 47% of professional Black women in my generation, Gen X, are unmarried and never married. I'm one of them with no children. It is a phenomenon that never happened before, and it has increased since that time. Jason, you teach at an HBCU, and 70 to 80% of that campus is female, right?
Is that high? I don't think it's that high. It's probably closer to 60-40, but okay.
Depending on which HBCU you go to, I've been to Southern and I spoke at, it was about 70%. My point is, Michael, she's going to present this image now that I think is very important. She got married at 50 for the first time. No children of her own, but a stepmom marries a successful man who's willing to step aside and let her shine, as you said. But I think you're going to see that open up a lot for, like you said, how men look at who they date the second time around, the first time around, how they engage with powerful women. I think it's a big shift that we're seeing. Josh Hawley is just a jackass. I'll just say it. So,
I think to your point, we were talking and my producer, we had a question about, we were going to ask him about that time during the primary in 2019, 2020, when the guy ran up on stage on then, you know, Senator Harris and how Emhoff responded. And the interesting thing about it is this was the day after Trump had attacked Vice President Harris at NABJ. So he's probably coming in hot. Right. And I asked him and I said, you know, how do you feel when you see, you know, she's a public figure, but how do you feel when you see your wife attacked like that? And the first thing that out of his mouth, he said, look, He's like, I'm Papa Bear. He's like, you remember when that guy came on stage? That's really how I am. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, okay. And it showed we are now in this world where it's like, oh, I know who I am. My wife is the baddest thing since sliced bread, but I also know who I am.
Right.
And I think it's a cross section, Mike. I agree with you as well. Yes, you have the Josh Hollies of the world who want to go on YouTube and Instagram and follow trad wives because they feel threatened all the time.
Right.
But you have another group of men across race, gender, class, or whatever, who are like, look, as long as I feel respected, my respect doesn't have to come from my ability to dominate this person who has chosen partnership with me. And that is, and people didn't feel that way about Hillary Clinton.
Right.
They thought Hillary Clinton was terrible and emasculating, right? That's not the energy that people seem to get from Harris. And
that's that generational shift that Sophia was talking
about.
Yeah. That clearly is generational.
And Hillary Clinton,
because I would say that feeling is still there about Kamala at a certain generational age, right? Yeah. But for men particularly who are 40 and younger, that vibe doesn't exist for them.
You're right. Yeah. I was going to say about Hillary, Jason, she actually, ironically, is so traditional. She stayed with her husband through adultery and all kinds of stuff. She's still with her husband.
Yeah.
So this feminist that everybody says she is, she actually broke those rules. Because a younger woman ideally would look at a man who cheated like that and be like, yeah, I'm good. I'm out.
It would be Elizabeth Warren, who's like, yeah. I can leave it for, you know, I remember talking to white friends of mine and some, not all, but some white women saying as Gen Xers that part of why they didn't like Hillary Clinton was because they were like, you sound like the feminist from my generation
right.
kept telling me this,
right.
but you stayed with this philandering husband that disrespected right. you. And now I don't believe you. Like there was an element to that. And I was like, oh, what? I mean, again, I'm not a 38-year-old white woman, but I understood that frustration with her. And what you have with Harris is this person who, again, the story that we want to tell about ourselves, right? Like, happily co-parenting. The fact that Doug Emhoff's first wife came out and tweeted like, no, Kamala Harris, we cool. She is an excellent stepmother to my children.
Right.
You're not going to come for us. Like, oh, wow. Okay, we're at the modern family territory here.
Yeah.
Right? Like everybody, people are blended. People are happy. People feel respected. And again, when I was talking to the second gentleman, you know, their 10-year wedding anniversary is this year. And we kind of chuckled about the fact that he's like, you know,
this week.
Yeah, this week. And he was like, I didn't think it was going to go here.
right.
But I'm ready for the ride. And I was like, there are a lot more men in this country who see that and are like, that could be my boss. That could be my sister-in-law. That's my coworker. That's my this, that, the other. I'm fine with this because, again, the alternative is something gross and terrible that I cannot justify to my wife, my daughter, my sister, or my best friend who's a woman from college. So that's going to be an interesting story again if she ends up being president.
And the cynic in me would say men get to the point where they go, you know what, I'm done. Y'all go ahead and do it. I'm tired. I'm gonna stay home with the kids. You walk in the park. I'm good. That's fine.
Right.
Lady, go ahead and do your thing.
You pick the Christmas cards. You know what, baby? You pick the Christmas cards. That's right.
I'll pick the Christmas cards.
I'm good.
You know what time you want dinner, I'll be home.
But Jason, you said something key. You said Doug said he was still Papa Bear, and he did run up on that stage. So, again, we want a strong, smart career, girls. You still want your man to be a man. You still want him to have your back.
Hey, sometimes you got to pop out.
And I've seen Doug, he knows how to stand back, but he knows how to stand right next to her, too. And I think that that's really the key. And she seems to adore him, which I think is great.
Well, I have adored this conversation, guys. You guys always just, you know, individually, I've had you on the podcast and have enjoyed you. But this combo meal was something extra.
Let's do
special.
It again.
Yeah,
something
definitely.
Extra special.
It was cheaper than the last one I got.
Okay, so Jason gonna hit a brother on the way out the door. I got you. Sophia Nelson, award-winning journalist and author, just an incredible friend. Thank you so much for taking time to be on the podcast. And my man, Dr. Jason Johnson, associate professor of politics and journalism, colleague of
mine. Oh, hold on. I got promoted this summer. I'm now full professor at Morgan State University. Yes, yes, I'm official. I've been promoted to full professor. So yeah, yes. Thank you.
Oh my God. So you doctor.
I'm now doctor. Now I can, you know.
Oh,
I tell people today, now I can set the school on fire. They can't get rid of me.
There you go, baby. That's how I love it. Well, congratulations, Professor Dr. Jason Johnson, David Johnson. But no, thank you both for taking time to be on the podcast. Really do appreciate it. And folks, I hope you had a little bit of fun with us. Some very interesting insights as we watch the conventions and all of the fun there. But then the game begins. The bell rings on Labor Day weekend, and we're off to the races because literally a week after that, voting starts around the country in various states. And you got to do that thing, folks. We need you out there. We need you to overwhelm the ballot box this November with your vote. And so hopefully you'll be able to do that for myself and my two friends, and most especially for our country. Till next time, be safe, be well. I'm still working on my tan in my undisclosed location. I hope you're working on yours where you are, because summer's coming to an end soon. So gotta get it right. Gotta get right and tight for the fall. Until next time, be well.